And welcome back to the program. You're listening to Sacred Space here in CJUM 101.5 FM out of Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. We're sitting here talking with Michael Tsarian, alternative historian, researcher, expert on the occult histories. And before we went to break, I wanted to ask you about the Anunnaki. So who are the Anunnaki?
Well, the same thing as the Nephilim, basically. Again, it's a matter of translation. But the word Anunnaki probably is originally something Egyptian, by way, you know, then it moved into Babylon or Samaria. It comes from the word Anunnaje, which means the heavenly serpents. Now, the word Nephilim also connotes serpent, by the way. It just it comes from several roots, but if the Nephilim, if it's Knef with a K, K-N-E-P-H, that is a word that relates to the serpent. And this is what, you know, what basically opens the whole ball of wax of my work, is because of the permutations of the serpent, the fact that Moses, you know, held the serpent. The Israelites have always used the symbol of the serpent. We have the serpent, you know, being used today. I mean, it's been used by Christian sects in the past. It's certainly been used even in Ireland, where there's no snakes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, we're talking about the serpent over there. We see the dragon dances of China. You know, see the serpents in the Maya iconography. You know, the Vikings have their serpent-shaped boats. I mean, what has gone on here with a serpent bit? And then you find that it's talked about a lot in the Bible. The words cherubim and seraphim even mean fiery serpents. So we got some major questions about the serpents. And, of course, if you look at the Egyptian mythology, you see this a lot. Now, I believe that the word Ankh, A-N-K-H, and I go into this in the Atlantis DVD, I believe that the word Ankh is a compressed or a sort of a derivation of the word Anunnaki. So that when you see the gods of Egypt holding that Ankh, that is a pictogram, a illustration, sort of like the way a general would wear, you know, his stripes or something, that actually represents the Anunnaki. Because the word Ankh, or Ankh, I believe, is a poor translation or a poor rendition of the word for the heavenly serpents. And it's very interesting to me that we find this heavenly serpent, you know, on many corporate logos today. We certainly find it on the medical corporations, you know, of the world, these monopolies. So this is what, you know, again, ties my work in very much to that this is not just something of ancient history. We got something going on here in the world before our eyes that has some very ancient roots.
When you talk about the Atlanteans, who were they?
Well, these are, you know, the people who actually constructed Atlantis or lived in Atlantis were these heavenly serpents, the ones who, you know, it wasn't earthbound creatures that, you know, used that. I mean, Atlantis, for a start, was not a continent. This is another big mistake that people have got from Plato's work. The continent that Atlantis was on was a continent called Appalachia, which was not far from where England is now in the Atlantic Ocean, just south of Greenland, Iceland, you see, in that area. And in fact, it used to be the continent of Appalachia, which sank beneath the waves, and these geologists have discovered it. I mean, it's right there. It's well known. I believe that the citadel or the city-state or the place of Atlantis was on this continent, and it went down, you know, it sank as well. That it was not, and also that there wasn't just one of these continents, there was several. There were several great continents of old that are talked about in the mythologies and are well known. And some of them were colonies of the Atlantean colony, and some were separate.
So maybe possibly some of the Lemurians. And what is the difference between Atlantis and Lemuria?
Well, you're right. This what Graham Hancock and others have been discovering off the coast of Ceylon, you know, these underwater ruins that have been found all over, more in the Pacific area, these to me are parts of the ancient continent of Lemuria, which may have actually included most of Antarctica, certainly Australia, New Zealand, Thursday Island, you know, that kind of area. And that they may have had, the Lemurians may have had outposts in what is today modern Bolivia, because enormous, inexplicable ruins have been discovered there. So I believe that if you're talking about what is now the Pacific Basin, and perhaps even, you know, Hawaii and all these places, they may have been part of the Lemurian complex, stretching all the way down to Australia. And if we're dealing with the northern climes, Hyperborea, Ultima Thule, you know, different things in mythology, the original Garden of Eden and Avalon, these are all aspects of Atlantis. These would have been outposts of Atlantis. And the difference is that Lemuria came later. Lemuria was settled a little bit after the time of the Atlanteans. In fact, the Lemurians were a breakaway sect of people who were not happy with what the Atlanteans, their own, and the Atlanteans would have been their forefathers. They were not happy with what these guys were doing. So they had a sort of a civil war.
That's what I thought, that there was a war between the two of them.
Yeah, this is the original War of the Gods. When they talk about the War of the Gods, they actually are talking about the civil war between the creation of the Atlanteans, their first offspring, rebelling against their fathers. And this, I believe, was also picked up in another echo of this, is picked up by Sigmund Freud when he realized that there was this tendency within, you know, tribal people, within the consciousness of human beings, to sort of overcome the father. His very famous book, Totem and Taboo, which was about, you know, how the sons conspire against overthrowing the father. He had noticed this particular complex in all human beings. For all we know, this may also have dated from the time when there was this enormous rebellion, you know, one of the first big rebellions on this planet, from sons basically to the fathers.
So are we Homo sapiens or Homo Atlanteans?
We're both. Depends on, again, it's all a play on words, and it's just a, you know, from whatever school you're coming from, Homo sapien is Homo Atlantis. You know, I know, I'm absolutely convinced that we're going to find this out soon. I mean, this month, top scientists have already shown that a great deal of the DNA of the human being is, in fact, alien. It doesn't exist in this world at all. You know, I have the latest facts on that. There's been Canadian scientists who've come out to show this, and I have the link on my blog. So if people go to the blog and they go to the Atlantis section of my blog, they'll be able to see this incredible revelation that's just hot off the press. I mean, this is literally very, very recent. And if they can get to the blog by going to my website, michaeltessarian.com. Mm-hmm. They'll see a link to the blog there. And then when you're on the blog, go to Atlantis section, and you'll see that there's this enormous, incredible revelation. So I believe, you see, we're coming to the time where we're going to have these facts that show exactly how old our history is, and that even before this visitation, you know, the human being lived in a completely different way on this planet. This is one of the things I'm mostly interested in also, is what were we doing on this planet? What kind of consciousness did we have before all of this visitation? Because the visitation, the War of the Gods, the destruction of the planet Tiamat, the deluge, the flood, the subsequent, upheavals on Earth, the cataclysms, all of this taken together constituted an enormous trauma visited upon the human consciousness.
This is where the evil came into the world?
Yes, this is where the evil came into the world, because I came into this subject from that school, from the philosophical question of why is man so cruel and inhuman and unjust? You know, I'm not a person from the UFO movement. I'm not a person from the paranormal movement at all. I got into those things, I got into the questions of Atlantis, because my own researches into the origins of evil took me there. Because I had some questions that were not being answered by, you know, biblicists, by historians, by scholars, by scientists, who just, you know, weren't giving anything close to accurate answers. And it was only when I started reading the individuals who were talking about visitation to this planet, you know, Eric von Däniken jumps to mind, you see, Brinsley, Lepore, Trench, and some other authors, that then, just like my book has been doing for so many people in the world, well, you know, I got put onto the same subject from reading, you know, authors that were speculating in this way. And my difference is that a lot of the authors who were speculating in this way, they tend to favor the Nephilim. They think that the Nephilim are the great brothers of mankind, you know, that they did a really good thing by upgrading all of us. And of course, this is what this latest article, even from the science world on the DNA, they also take that line. Well, see, I've never taken that line, even from the 70s when I first started getting into this. I did not believe, like Eric von Däniken, and Zachariah Sitchin, you see, and a lot of these other writers all believe that this was just so wonderful. This, you know, a bone-chucking cave dweller on Earth, you know, suddenly got a spiritual upgrade because of the visitation of alien brothers, you know. And I've never bought into that, you know, Star Trek palava. I don't believe in that at all. I think it was the worst thing that ever happened, and it interfered with our natural destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not believe that, you know, prior to 50,000 years ago, we were the primitive, bone-chuckers that everybody, right, in the science community, believes that we were. I do not believe that for one minute.
Just discovering fire.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, shivering in the dark and, you know, scared of every noise in the sky. I believe that was our pathetic condition after the trauma. Yeah. After our DNA had been spliced, after transgenic experimentations had been done on us, after our Earth had been wrecked by the most ferocious storms that wiped out most of the fauna and flora on the planet, after whole, you know, planets were known to have gone missing in our solar system, etc., 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 after the rising of tyrannous empire states of the throughout Mesopotamia, and wars of bloodshed, and yeah, I can tell you where the trauma comes from. It's not from anything prior to visitation, it's post-visitation. Hmm. And one of the most interesting aspects which I deal with in my work is that, again, it's more of a philosophical, psychological component, which very few people within the paranormal movement have ever dealt with, is that the birth of the ego, what we have today is our waking ego consciousness, that thing you wake up every day with and think with, is also a result of the trauma. And that is why it operates in such horrendously, you know, infantile, limbic ways. Biologists, brain surgeons, you know, have already discovered that we have the R complex, the limbic realm. But what they don't tell you is where the limbic realm came from. They're convinced it's, again, a legacy of millions of years. No, it's not. The limbic drives of instinct and, you know, warlikeness and flight and fight and survivalism and just this primitive instinctual nature is not millions of years old. That's another lie. It is definitely in our being to be like that, but that is the result of this trauma that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But infinitely more interesting than that is that the ego itself, the thing that we refer to as the ego, which unfortunately most people have never thought about what the ego is or what mind is. You know, I try to talk to audiences about this subject only to find out that most people have never even thought about thinking. They're not even aware of, wait a minute, what is the Jungian, you know, fourfold aspect of the psyche? Or what is the Freudian tripartite, you know, system of consciousness? I mean, most people, you know, have grown up and they don't even know that. They're not even thinking about what is the mind? What is this thing I use every day? Mm-hmm. What is this thing that has me constantly troubleshooting, you know, my life and keeps me in so much angst? And there's this thing that have this inner, constant inner dialogue going on. This thing that I have in an interior life as opposed to the exterior life of nature and the world out there. But here I am walking around in division with my little own personal voice, you know, my little narcissistic drives and needs inside. And then there's this whole other spectacular thing going on outside in the world. And you know, people take this all as normal. They're in a totally pathological situation and have completely accustomed themselves to it.
It wasn't Eve that caused the fall of man.
Oh, well, this is what the Bible wants you to believe. This is what the Christians want you to believe, because they'll do anything. They'll concoct any story to, number one, work on your lower drives, but primarily to keep you as far away as possible from really asking serious questions about consciousness and about that story, and about, you know, is man really superior? Is he? What do you mean when he's made in the image of God? You know, who is this serpent that's meant to be so powerful that God, you know, sort of lets him talk to these innocents, and then he blames the innocents? You know, I have a whole chapter on this paradox in the Bible about why, in my book, why would God even allow this evil serpent anywhere near his new creations, and then allow them to be tempted and all of these kinds of things? The church has never answered these questions sufficiently.
Doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
No, it doesn't, but it makes sense when you discover what the tree and the serpent really refers to.
That's what I was actually just going to get to. Where does the tree of life fit into all this?
Well, the tree of life is an old euphemism, going back to the earliest dynasties of Ireland and Egypt, back into India. Do you know that in some of these early carvings that you can find in southern India, it was a Colonel Dow of the British Army, who's an anthropologist, actually discovered carvings in India of a woman sitting near the tree with a serpent, Garden of Eden scenes. But in the Indian versions, George, the serpent was a benign influence, an enlightener, a bringer of wisdom to the parents, the primal parents. And that mythology is corroborated in all the other mythologies of the world, that the serpent is actually nothing more than a symbol of occult or secret or hidden knowledge. And that its coming to the primal parents was a benevolent thing to rise them out of stupidity, mm-hmm. and rise them out of ignorance, specifically the female.
Well, we can't have that.
Right. So what happened was this ancient Babylonian, Sumerian, Indian, Druidic myth that was known through all over the world was used and then again twisted, because evil cannot create anything. Evil can only twist that which has been created by great minds. Mm-hmm. So all these mythologies were assembled and they were twisted to tell another tale, a propaganda story. And, you know, it's very, very important for people to have a very false conscience. Because, again, if you're divided in your gender, that's another division. That's another healthy division for the people of the world, the controllers, to use on you.
Yeah, divide and conquer.
Yeah. Now your sexuality is even divided. Now you're going to project all your blame onto women of the world, you see, and vice versa. Then women who've been recipient of that kind of intense open physical violence, the removal from positions of power, the prevention of them holding spiritual office like they used to do in Egypt. In Egypt, there's women had absolutely equal power. They were paid the same amount of wage for any jobs that they did. They had all sorts of spiritual and religious and social office. There's no such thing as prejudice over there. You can't have that. But if women then have to subsequently suffer, you see, being held, their instinctual energies, their libido, is perpetually trained and conditioned and told that they're inferior and told that they're wicked, eventually women start acting exactly like that, either consciously or unconsciously, because they need the, you can't bottle up somebody's energy permanently. So then women's psyche becomes this miasma of conflict. And women start using a form of psychic and emotional violence of their own, because they've had to withstand enormous tyranny, you see, and the canalization of their natural energies. So the fate of women is also very much tied up into this, mm-hmm. and the loss of the destiny for women, to forget that they are actually custodians of the knowledge, that they're meant to be highly involved in mystical tradition, because they once were the keepers of it, you see, and they're not just meant to be serving the beast out there, you know, pushing the wheel.
And that's why the women and indigenous races have been suppressed and slaughtered through the ages.
Right. In all the religions, it's the same story.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't expect the men to then wake up and change. Let the women understand what is going on and change themselves. Let them find out, you know, that this doesn't need to continue, that you don't need to buy into all of this, these stupid customs and traditions and religions that suppress your energy. What are they doing? Waiting for man to suddenly wake up, just like, you know, with the problem with the Negroes and the blacks? You're going to wait for white men to emancipate them? They don't want to do it themselves? Is women going to wait till men become, you know, aware that this is the wrong situation? What kind of a ludicrous situation would that be? Why can't they do it themselves? How come it has to be D.H. Lawrence writing about female emancipation and, you know, and the awakening of the female spirit? How come it has to be a man doing it? Because, again, you're dealing with people who wake up to this only on a very limited level. The feminists who understand that there's been great, you know, what you would call injustice done to them, only are moving from a tunnel vision of now we need to do the same.
Right.
Now we need to wake up and, you know, now we need to sort of become tyrants in our own stead.
Yeah, now it's our turn.
Now it's our turn. Wait a minute, that's all? That's you know, that's what your degree has got you? That to understand that, you know, get out of tyranny and become the next generation of tyrants? No. To truly be psychologically and attitudinally free requires more than just to, you know, free yourself from a form of slavery. It means to completely develop and mature to the state that you were in before you were enslaved. But I don't see any of that. They're just exchanging chains of iron for chains of gold. Where have you ever seen a women's group recently that has stood up against the massacres that are happening to women and children in Iraq?
I can't say that I have.
No. When's the last time you saw them petitioning the White House or taking a million woman march down there to do that? They'll do it for some meaningless, tawdry, domestic, social reason. Gays can come out in millions to march over some nonsense, you know, because they can't marry their own kind or some other nonsense. But men, women, and children are being slaughtered, right, in a massive genocide. Where do you see the women of the world getting together in any kind of organization to go and do anything about it and say, we rally with the women of Iraq or we rally with the women of the world, we're going to put a stop to this? You know something? It would happen, by the way. If women really did this, it would happen. But it doesn't happen because I'm trying to explain to you that men and women are intensely violent creatures, one to the other. And most people think that freedom is when you can do more violence to your enemy than they can do to you. It's like that old Leonard Cohen song, All I Learned About Love Is That, you know, you can outdraw the other person. We have a long, long way to go before we can really chant, you know, about freedom and emancipation and all of these kinds of nonsensical things.
So why is it that it makes it so easier to believe a lie than it is the obvious?
It goes to the heart of what the great American philosopher said, Vernon Howard. He said, why healing fails to occur is because it is much easier to hurt another than heal oneself. It all has to do with the massive meta-conditioning. We've been talking a little bit about gender conditioning. There's a greater form of conditioning over that. Trauma brought the ego into birth. And the ego has basically been troubleshooting its relationships with the outer world. But there's an inner world. As even Bruce Lipton and the scientists have now proven, 99.9% of your consciousness is unconsciousness. The psyche is made up of vast amounts of unconscious content. And the so-called ego waking consciousness is pathetically minute. Jung, Freud, they all talk about the preconscious, the unconscious, you see? The religious people have talked about the realm of the soul. Another way, existentially, you can put it that there's mind think and there's brain think. But for some unknown reason, and it's probably because the shamans of the world, those teachers who used to introduce you to your inner thinking, to the individual, are all gone. They're all dead. So we live in a world now which is highly extrovert in nature, in which we're always outer-directed, and we're waiting for the stimulus of the world to turn us on. But that is a paltry kind of existence. The real existence is to work with uniqueness, to find out that you are a self, that you are unique under the stars, there's only one of you, and that you must become fully conscious of the miracle of your own selfhood, right from the sensual level all the way up to the causal level and into the spiritual level. To become fully aware of that. Now, that doesn't mean fully aware of your ego's brilliance, which is, you know, what most people are doing. That's a form of narcissism, where you're so enraptured by your own so-called ego, you know, ability. It's like a child is fixated with one toy. Well, what you see with all of this physical culture and this aggrandizement cosmetically and in the cult of appearance and, you know, the exercise fanaticism and just the me, myself, and I, that's not true selfhood at all. That's infatuation with the ego and its world and what it can give you, and then the accessories and the decoration of the ego.
Mm-hmm.
But the mystical tradition, the psychological tradition, is about a full, comprehensive understanding of the miracle of your own uniqueness. But that is the very thing that is erased and prevented from the moment that we enter into this world. And the parents are responsible, you know, even if they're not aware of it, and the teachers certainly are, you know. So we have a culture in which you're not able to investigate your selfhood. You're not able to find out how absolutely unique you are. In fact, your uniqueness is something that is, you know, ironed out.
Yeah.
And we have people now living on the periphery of being. They're not even close to their own authentic inner voice.
God, no.
And this is a critical problem for our age.
2007 is really the beginning to get to 2012, really.
Yeah, it's a countdown. It's been a countdown that's been going on since 1999, if you go by the Maya calendar.
Yeah.
But even if the Mayan calendar's on or it's off a little bit, it really doesn't matter, because this is all to do with the coming in the end of the age of Pisces. We're in the final degrees of the age of Pisces, according to the Western, you know, astrological system.
Yeah.
And that's just sort of an equivalent to what the Maya were saying, that around about 2012, they're talking about a major countdown where their age ends. And I believe it's the age of the human being that ends. I don't believe that most people on this planet are human. They don't operate in a human way. To operate in a human way is easy to understand. Aristotle, the Greeks, have written volumes on it. And it simply means to be a virtuous person, a moral person. Virtue is not just quite morality. There's a bit of an understanding here. Virtue, morality, is not just a person doing good deeds. Because even a criminal can do that. Even a, you know, a serial killer can operate, you know, in his daily life doing good, like
yep.
when he's at his job, you see. So everybody can do this performance, which we call, you know, being non-criminal or being, you know...
being a good citizen.
Yeah, good citizen, whatever. That's not morality. That is not what the Greeks were talking about, but virtue. Virtue is a condition, an inherent condition of the soul that I believe is very much connected with a person's experience, a person's own depth. It's like we were saying, we're dragged from that place. We're not even able to get in touch with this inner place. Virtue is not just the performance of, you know, good deeds in order to get some ego-gratifying return. It is a absolute embodied condition of the self. And this is what distinguishes human beings from one to the other.
Yeah.
And we're living in a world now that is, you know, so removed from that. We're almost unvirtue. Immorality and amorality is openly promoted and openly rewarded.
The exact opposite of what should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I believe that the human race is on its way out, if you define human. I mean, you may be still walking around on the streets of the world after 2012, but that's meaningless.
That's...
If you don't have a conscience inside, if
yeah.
you're walking dead. And I got you know, to tell you that when I walk around in the world right now, I think I'm amongst the walking dead.
Ditto.
As horrible as it is to say.
Yeah, ditto.
So we're not in the Victorian age when there was an immense sense of virtue and morality in people. Not cultivated. Of course, you always have the people who've got it, who cultivated it. But it was in people. That's what produced those wonderful Pre-Raphaelite paintings. That's what produced the incredible poetry, you see, from Shelley and Byron and Hardy and Tennyson and all of this. There was an enormous sense still within people, even just 100 years ago.
I hear this question all the time. Why don't we have any more Mozarts or Shakespeare's?
Well, you can't have those people because their creativity is an epiphenomena, a symptom of a deep and abiding selfhood, a very deep interior life, a sense of introversion, a connection to the true voice. And it's also an extension of these people's morality and true humanity, not as a political concept, not as some cozy campus, you know, jive that you've learned, parroted, like good for all and humanity for all. You know, instantly in the 60s, they were all running around screaming about injustice, for, you know, Vietnam. And then it cools down and those people go right back to the beast.
Isn't there
enough injustice in America long before the time of the Vietnam War that people should have been going absolutely berserk about? I'm not complaining that they, you know, they stood up, but that was an important idiom, an important moment in history, sure. But you're going to tell me that that's... What about the Native American Indians? Wasn't that another Holocaust in America that the people should have been standing up every campus?
You bet.
It was just yawn about that, you know, or the dumping of nuclear waste on the back door of reservations. Come on, you tell me that they can't find a reason. You know, there's even ordinary people in America starving all over the major cities. Incredible injustices is being done on a corporate level, and nobody even, you know, doing barely anything about that.
Yeah.
This is the kind of hypocrisy. It's okay when it's a foreign nemesis, when it's something far away, when it's removed from your own shore. It seems that people will jump for all of those things, because again, that's training. You take a fantastic stallion and you train it every hour on the hour with a whip, you know, from morning till night. It is going to do the most dumbest tricks for you.
Yeah.
Like the elephant, you know.
Yeah, or the dolphin.
I said before,
or
the elephant, the wisest of animals, will do every kind of dumb trick if you train it. Well, the human being was once the wisest of animals. He's the creature who can think about his own thought processes. Look at him now. You walk around, you know, I was on a show with Jeff Rentz, and I was talking about this very thing we're talking about how you don't see any soul in people's eyes. He said something amazing to me. He said, you don't even feel that they have a spirit. When you're even with them talking to some people, you don't even feel anything from them. And I just stopped. I went, you know, that's an amazing statement you just said. So this is a condition. This is a pathology that can be cured, but you have to diagnose it correctly. My job, you know, is partly to diagnose this thing correctly so that people know what is really wrong. It's an existential problem within human beings.
Well, I tell you, I did a Chenrezig meditation with the Dalai Lama a number of years ago in 90, I believe it was. And it's a heart chakra meditation. And after I came out of that, I'm in downtown Seattle, and all I could see was people's pain. That's it. Tears were just streaming down my face. I was telling my friend beside me, I need a park or a tree that I can put my back against and just ground, because this opening is just, it's not good, because all I'm seeing is people's pains, because that's all they're carrying anymore is pain.
And this pain arises from living a lie.
And that's exactly it. And I think that's it, too. I mean, instinctively, one has to know.
Oh, of course they do.
You know, that you're not being yourself.
But see, being oneself carries with it a great burden of another kind.
Well, you have to take responsibility then.
Yeah. Like becoming a martial artist, being able to wield a sword, like being an expert horseman, like, you know, learning how to be a great computer programmer. All of this kind of stuff takes a lot of work. Well, being a self requires a kind of moral work, which is only to be found, you see, in the great authors, the great musicians, the great artists. You know, when you look at a Vermeer painting, really look at one I'm talking about, or a Van Gogh, you're looking at a moral creature.
I talk about Van Gogh all the time.
Production of a superman, a super moral, an advanced, and I use the word superior without any shame, a superior person, not superior mentally or whatever, but a superior morally, and a man who walks very, very close to his other brothers and sisters in the world. He's not running around arrogantly thinking, hey, I'm superior. He is superior, and that superiority, that natural moral aristocracy that he has, causes an intense burden of pain, because he's deeply empathic to the people, you see, who are not equally aware. Suffers for them. I refer to it as the Hamlet complex.
Yeah.
He is suffering for the unawakenedness of other people. It's like in the Bible, they accept Christ as a superior being, no problem. Nobody ever complains about that. But what did Christ say? I can only spend what I've got in my purse. He says, when his disciples ask, how can you forgive these people? How can you be so, you know, empathic with them? He's saying, well, I can only do what I am. I can only be the person I am. It's not an effort. Well, that's what I'm talking about. That kind of natural instinct. And he tried to surround himself with people of the same ilk. Unsuccessfully, I might add, but nevertheless, he gave it a try. So the idea is that there are people in the world who are divided amongst themselves, and this pain is the stress, the anxiety, because fear and anxiety are different. But the pain of living an inauthentic life is, to me, the supreme ancestor of all the other complexes and problems that we have, especially leading down to the fact that ultimately, if you try to live an authentic life, then you mark yourself as an outsider. You basically now have defined yourself as an outsider. As soon as you change that status quo, as soon as you say, well,
instantly,
wait a minute, I think I'm living an inauthentic life here. I don't want to do that anymore. Gee, if you try that, you are automatically have another problem, which is that you're ostracized and you're a threat to all those people who have not chosen this likewise. Now, that is where people stand. Most of the people you see, especially if they're fashion freaks, and even if they don't appear to be, you know, if they're addicted to television or all these things, or they don't set boundaries with their friends and so on, you're dealing with a person who then is standing in that exact twilight zone of thinking, but it's safer. I know I really should be myself, but, you know, I really crave the company of these others. I would feel kind of lonely. I need the party. I need to be fit in.
I need to
but
fit
every
in.
Every one of those people, as you said, George, knows inside, just because they don't give themselves enough time to think about it doesn't change our point.
Yeah,
they do know, you know.
That's exactly why the busyness of this society is the quick fix, and so that you don't have time to think.
That's right. And why do you think it is that those people, then, when they're in the cluster, why do they condemn openly? Just watch people, just watch gangs, just watch groups of friends, how they'll condemn and immolate and deeply hurt, you know, the person who's the outsider. How would they do that if they weren't thinking about it, or they didn't understand on some level that being an outsider was terribly threatening? Why would they then be the people to bully those who are?
Yeah.
So you better believe that they understand it. They know that they're committing crime to themselves. The crime that you see them committing outside, from bullying to genocide, is perpetuated by this inner cruelty to oneself. Because the more that you follow with the collective, the more that you deny selfhood, the less you live an authentic life. These are all forms of violence to the self. This is what is the core of my work, is to show that people are more violent to themselves than they are to other people. And we, yet, as a human race, are very, very unaware of the way, the forms in which we're violent to others. I mean, violent to the self.
Yeah. We're going to take our last break here, and when we come back, I want to get right into this and ask you what a schizogenic society is.
Thank you.
Here is Pink Floyd and Two Suns in the Sunset. Enjoy.